Tuesday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. Got a great show coming up for you today. First, we got some news. We got Michael Kidd-Gilchrist is coming back. Joakim Noah, unfortunately, may not be in Chicago after his shoulder injury. A couple more little injury tidbits. And then we get through tonight's games. And also the news that Team USA has come out with its 30 finalists for the 2016 Olympic team. And Danny and I are going to talk about who should and will make that roster. Danny, what's up?
Not like we're going to have a shortage of opinions on that matter, I'm sure.
That's actually one of my favorite things to talk about. I'm quite the homer patriot when it comes to USA basketball. That's the one thing that I still try to... I think I can still be objective, obviously, but that is the one team that I just unabashedly root for because I just could not stand it during the years when everyone was saying that, oh, U.S. basketball was so terrible and we weren't as good anymore, because those years that we were losing, we just weren't sending our best players.
Yeah. I don't really have much more to add because I agree with you completely
ardent,
on that.
Ardent patriot Danny LaRue agrees with me. All right, let's get to some of the news here. Depressing out of Chicago. Joakim Noah had the shoulder injury, was out 2-3 weeks, came back. Wasn't wearing one of those shirts. Not that I'm sure that would, those like stabilizing black shirts that some of the guys with shoulder issues wear. Not that that would have prevented anything, of course. And then dislocated his shoulder, you know, the same injury basically that K-Love had, that Kidd-Gilchrist actually had. And it looks like out 4 to 6 months, which is essentially the rest of the season. And the speculation is now that his career in Chicago could be over.
Yeah, and that's tough to take because, you know, we've talked about the idea of, you know, him coming back a little bit on the early side of the projections would mean that the Bulls would have a better chance to kind of evaluate it. And now, I wouldn't say that it's kind of set what they're going to do, but I think this limits their options. And also, if this is the end of Noah's career with the Bulls, considering the heights that they reached, it would be pretty disappointing to have it end on that note, especially when they're are some very real aspirations for success in the playoffs. I mean, probably not in NBA Finals, but they could do well this year.
How much does this hurt them, do you think, this year and also just from a potential trade/asset standpoint?
I don't think it hurts them, you know, a ton. It's not catastrophic, but it hurts them in a couple ways. I think the biggest one is that they have a lot of kind of short-term front court pieces, and I think this means that they're probably not really going to get assets for it, whether it would have been the Noah that they moved or Gasol or somebody.
Yeah, they no longer have a surplus to move.
Correct. And I think that he brought something which was very useful to this team. It wasn't necessarily always true that I thought he was used correctly, but a guy who can play good defense, and even if his offensive game wasn't what it was 2 years ago, that can still provide value to this team. And anytime you lose somebody like that, especially when they have an emotional resonance, that's always challenging for a team, and we'll have to really see how they adapt to that and how they react. I mean, they did get a win after that on Martin Luther King Day against the Pistons.
I don't see any way that their defense in the aggregate is going to be good enough now without him on that second unit, because now they basically have Gasol, Taj Gibson, and then two power forwards. You don't really protect the rim at all in Portis and Mirotić. So it's hard for me to see how the defense is going to be good enough now. I mean, especially you've got like guys like McDermott in the rotation. Dunleavy is not going to solve a ton of the defensive issues, although he's a smart player. Butler is pretty good defensively. Snell is okay. Etuan Moore is pretty good. But you know, it's really with Gasol now probably going to have to play 35 minutes a game in the playoffs. It's hard for me to see how they get their defense to that elite level. And it's really a shame for Noah because I felt like he actually was moving better this year. He had regained confidence, and just recently in his offense before he had that first shoulder injury, he actually had 21 points. He was attacking again off the dribble, actually hitting a couple of those tornadoes. And I wanted to see what he could do as the starting center, at least as a high minute backup playing next to guys like Mirotić and McDermott. I thought that was just such a promising combination. Those two guys, Noah and Mirotić, and they, in their year and a half together, just barely played with one another, essentially.
Of course, it will depend a lot on the offers, and we won't know a lot of that story, not only until then, but even after then. But intuitively, to me, he seems like somebody who'd be a very interesting play to sign a short-term deal and bet on himself, because if the market is a little bit lower on him, though it's going to be high for everybody, and then go in. But at the same time, you know, he's a guy who's getting older, and if an offer that's better than, you know, maybe better than I expect or just better overall comes in, then he has to take it.
It's a shame he's not a couple years younger, because now at 31, it's hard for him to do a one-year bet on yourself, and now you're going to hope to sign a long-term deal after that at 32. And it's hard for me to see a team offering him, you know, an eight-figure annual salary for more than maybe 1 year, given the health concerns now, two years that he's been kind of injured. I thought he did look better physically, but then now he also has age in addition to the fact that he's been, you know, has these injury concerns. So, yeah, I mean, it's a shame for the Bulls. I still, maybe they could even still be that second best team in the East come playoff time. But whatever slim to none chances they had against Cleveland are now trending towards none, because they don't have anybody to protect the rim. And that's something that is key against a Cleveland team with LeBron James and Kyrie Irving.
And they also now have basically no front court wiggle room now. You know, if anything subsequent happens to any of those guys, then they don't have the depth to replace them.
Now, there was talk that they might trade one of those guys, too. I mean, I don't think it's the end of the world. You know, the best you're going to get, even probably for like a Taj Gibson, is a protected first rounder. Obviously, they now cannot trade him. I didn't even really, if their goal was to be good this year, I didn't really advocate trading any of those guys. Anyway, I don't think that Portis is necessarily ready. And now that he's on the scouting report, he's fallen off a little bit offensively. There was one, Nick Friedell, actually, of ESPN Chicago, actually advocated trading Pau Gasol. I don't really see that happening. Do you?
I don't see it happening. I've been saying they should do it for a long time, but saying my belief in that is very, very different from them actually doing it, and they won't do it.
Yeah, it's on the surface somewhat analogous to the Luol Deng situation, where you know you had a potential free agent coming up, and then a guy went out for the year, but that was Derrick Rose, and that was kind of like a lost year, basically, as far as championship contention. I don't think they are championship contenders this year either, but they still have Derrick Rose. They still have Jimmy Butler. They still could make the second round or even the conference finals, you know, just as plausibly as anyone else in the East outside of Cleveland. So I don't see them just punting on that to avoid losing Gasol for nothing this off season. And I mean, what are you going to get for him? Maybe a protected first rounder. Like, is that worth, you know, really punting on any chance of getting into the second round if you move on from Gasol this year, unless you can somehow get another center back and another wing for him. But that seems pretty unlikely. And then I don't even think there are that many contenders that are going to be, you know, champion at the bit to get Gasol anyway.
Yeah, like I've been toying around with Gasol to the Thunder trades, even though the Thunder have two centers that they already like, just because I think the offensive fit would be so much fun. And then even then, like with Thunder, a team that has is on the cusp, like they're one of those teams that's kind of in that area, you can't really even figure out a fake trade that's realistic with those two teams.
All right, let's get on to some more happy news with Michael Kidd-Gilchrist returning for the Hornets. They are not out of it yet. They had that dominating win against the Hawks, then and they also beat the Jazz in the amazing 50-point performance from Kemba Walker. They also dropped another game over the weekend, so they're still around the edges of the race. I think Kidd-Gilchrist could come back because he now would finally give them a true small ball four option. I don't really think playing him on the wing is going to work that well. Maybe if you're playing him with Kaminsky, a guy, or Marvin Williams as well. But that, I mean, that actually could be pretty intriguing if you have Batum, MKG, and Marvin Williams all playing together. You can switch 2 through 4, no problem. I don't know. It'll be very interesting to see what he does for the Charlotte team that has succeeded a lot by shooting a lot more threes and having more spacing, but also, you know, doesn't really have that defender who's going to make you uncomfortable.
And this is a Hornets team that, you know, getting more good minutes is definitely going to be something that helps them. I think the way that I consider MKG is that offensively he's a four and defensively he's whatever you want him to be. And that works a lot better with Charlotte's current team than it did with the team he played on last year. And that's really encouraging, and why I'm very happy that we get to see it for however long we get to see it this year, is because, you know, this I think is more like what they can expect, because they've signed Michael Kidd-Gilchrist to a long-term contract. And so you want to see how he fits with more of a kind of a space-oriented lineup. And I mean, I've always thought that his defensive prowess was enough to justify him, even though he kind of hampers that style a little bit, just because he can do so many other things to make that to make everything else work. And I'm interested in Kaminsky, Marvin Williams, just a lot of the different things they can do. And the idea that, you know, you're just getting, even if it's just like 25 minutes a night, from a guy who's just a really good basketball player.
We'll see. He's not back yet. He's just been cleared to return to contact practice. We'll see how long it takes him. He does have a somewhat rough and tumble style.
He does.
So we'll see. You know, it could be 2 weeks. It could even be a month before he returns. But it does look like he at least will be returning this season. Let's get to today's games. What do you want to start with?
You don't want to talk about Eric Gordon?
we'll get to that in the New Orleans game.
Oh.
Maybe we can start with that then. Now that
we already talked about it.
Yeah. The Wolves had 38 points in the first quarter of this game. Everyone was trashing New Orleans defense then. They managed only 61 the rest of the game, including some fouling, you know, down the end, even though the game was pretty much out of reach. Minnesota, again, you kind of saw how young they were on defense, because the strategy was clearly anytime Norris Cole is in the game, we're just going to help off him. And even Rubio, who usually can be trusted to do well, and Levine, who played all the backup point guard minutes in this game, and the Wolves lost control of the game when he was at backup point guard in the late third, early fourth quarter. But the strategy was to double off of Norris Cole, and so they would do that, and then either end up like being ineffective with the double team, or like fouling Anthony Davis, or, you know, not even making Norris Cole shoot most of the time, whereas most teams are able to really like stymie New Orleans' offense by executing that strategy.
Yeah, and I think some of that will just take time. Like, you know, you have that with young guys. We've talked before about how young guys just struggle on defense. You know, they're facing different kind of talent. And what was funny for me is the part of this game I watched the most closely was the first quarter. And so you watch that and you're like, oh, the Wolves are playing okay. You know, the Pelicans defense did look shaky. I think in that first quarter, that was the bigger story to me, was just the Pelicans defense was just giving up open shots against the Minnesota team that sometimes can just get lost out there. And then, you know, then Minnesota just doesn't score the rest of the game. And one thing I didn't, that concerned me in this game and moving forward, I've been thinking about Wiggins a lot recently. And what I'm struggling with a little bit with him is, assuming he ends up taking a smaller role in a more successful offense, his flaws, catch and shoot in particular, are going to become a bigger issue, because that's something you're generally asked to do more when you have the ball in your hands less.
He is now shooting 28% for his career on three-pointers, 25% this year. Not a particularly efficient percentage on long twos either. League average is about 40%. He's shooting about, you know, in the kind of mid to high-ish 30s on that, you know, 36, 37% for his career now. And you make an excellent point there that if he's not going to be at least the number two option, he darn well better get that 3-and-D game going. And while he has the tools for the D part, he has one of the worst defensive RPMs in the league. You know, we talked quite a bit about his flaws defensively, like on that podcast with Jim Peterson that I did. And, you know, he can't hit a standstill three-pointer either now. And so you have to, if he doesn't mature into a primary option, he has a long, long way to go as a passer for that, and as a shooter. Then, you know, I mean, he could be a little bit in the wilderness if you really want him to be on a good team. I thought the most fascinating part of this game, though, was the matchup between Karl Towns and Anthony Davis, two number one picks, obviously both out of Kentucky. They were matched up for quite a bit of the game, and when they were, AD really dominated Towns to a large degree.
Did that surprise you at all? I mean, I think that Towns, we both really like Towns' long-term potential, but I think Davis has the physical tools to make that a challenge, especially for me. Some of it was like just having his ball handle and just being, even though he's young, his savvy and experience.
Yeah, I think that was right. And, you know, when Towns was matched up against Oshik early on, he was able to actually get a three-pointer off a flex down screen. I mean, of course, he only took one three-pointer. But he made that. That's going to be a play that's going to be totally unstoppable if, you know, whoever his next coach is actually incorporates that a little bit more. But, you know, Towns did post up a lot. He had five turnovers, a three-second violation, traveling violations. Whenever AD was on him, AD really sped him up in the post. It was a lot of faking from Towns, a lot of like quick hooks, a few of which he made, but he definitely was uncomfortable and rushing with Davis's athleticism. As Towns gets stronger, gets a stronger base, stronger core, he will be able to deal with guys like Davis by really backing them in and scoring using his body, but he's not quite at that point yet. And then he was not able to keep up with AD's mobility moving around for jump shots either while still helping out at the rim when they went with the Anderson-Davis front court.
Well, yeah, part of what makes Towns special is that I think he does a really good job against guys that are slower than he is. And you see that at various moments. There was a play, I can't remember if it was in this game or in the last game I saw of him, where he just basically, he took two dribbles from right around the three-point line and just made it. I can't remember, I think he laid it up. It was just like, that's the type of play that, at this stage in his career at least, he can do that against the center. Like, theoretically, if he had to face Nikola Pekovic, like when he doesn't practice, then those kind of guys he can do that against. But Anthony Davis has those attributes kind of in spades, and so those guys will be trouble for him. And as you said, that's when you need to go to the other tools in your toolbox, which is actually something I think Wiggins needs to get better at too, is just being able to find to exploit the weakness of whoever's on you.
The Wolves bench got destroyed in this game. It was Levine, Kevin Martin, Muhammad, Gorgui Dieng, Bielitsa. All those guys were, played between 13 and 27 minutes. All of them were in the double digits negative. Levine at point guard, still not that great. Although, Levine wasn't jacking a bunch of bad shots. He was 2 out of 5 in 18 minutes. Shabazz has scored well. He's been scoring well. I think they said he was averaging 15 points a game over his last few games. But those guys all together, Kevin Martin, the vet who plays like a rookie still on defense, that bench is just always going to get destroyed. They lost by 15, and Towns and Wiggins were both quite positive on the night.
Yeah, well, part of that was fueled by that really good first quarter. And, part of the issue for me with Minnesota is just that when they play a unit like that, it just there isn't a cohesive – the way they have to beat teams is by making a ton of shots. And they can. They have a lot of offensive talent in that group. But – my issue with Levine in terms of isn't necessary as a point guard, as a primary ball handler, I'll make that distinction. I whine about that sometimes, is I don't think he's great at creating offense for other people. That's not necessarily because he's looking for his first. It's just that I don't think he's very good at that. And
I agree.
And so when you have him and that's his responsibility, it doesn't matter because that's just not what he's good at. And so Kevin Martin, at an earlier time in his career, could have taken that mantle from him and just been like, okay, I can create for myself. This isn't a problem. But Kevin Martin's in his 30s now, and he can't do that like he used to. And Jang is, I think, an intriguing defender. He's not at that level yet. And so I think you want to balance that a little bit more. And what's so frustrating for me with this team is if you put Levine or Muhammad more with the first unit, then you kind of balance out the playmaking career, not playmaking, but just like the offensive talent in that unit. And theoretically, if it's Prince or whoever in that second unit, you give them a little more creation. Ideally, you put Tyus Jones in there too. That's just me. And that they're just doing it this way. It's just setting themselves up to be disappointing. And that's not the worst thing in the world with where they are. I think that, if they have another kind of low year, as long as they use this time to figure out what they have, that's fine. But you want it to be a little bit better than what it is. A
couple more small notes on this game. The Wolves played Tayshaun Prince at the 4. Probably not really your greatest lineup, although he did actually hit a 3-pointer. The Wolves really still just don't have any kind of power forward of the future unless Bielitsa can come around. I'm becoming more and more pessimistic about his athleticism as time goes on. And for the Pelicans, their lineups continue to be like quite the mishmash as well. We still didn't see any of their 5 best players playing together in this game that I recall. Eric Gordon actually may be out for some time. He was diagnosed with a fractured ring finger on his right hand, and that's one of their 5 good players. So they could be, and really their only guy who's a great shooter among their wing guys. So that could be an issue as well. Jrue Holiday continues to play well. They continue to do well with him on the floor. Maybe now he and Tyreke Evans are going to start next to one another, but I think they're still kind of trying to keep Drew's minutes down a little bit. But it's just finding the lineups that make sense are pretty difficult. You can tell that Alvin Gentry is still searching. He started Omer Asik, barely played him in the second half, went with the Jinsa instead. He didn't really do much. Finding a third big who's been effective has been difficult. They've been shuttling between G and Dante Cunningham. Cunningham did a nice job on Wiggins, but it's not, neither of those guys is really a guy you want to rely on night to night from an offensive standpoint. So this is against the Wolves, who have been one of the worst teams in the league for basically the past 2 months. I wouldn't be incredibly encouraged as New Orleans starts this 7-game homestand as sort of their last stand to get back into things. All right, before we move on to our next game, it's time to tell you about SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the inaugural sponsor of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. And whether you're looking to buy tickets to a game or sell tickets that you can't use, check out SeatGeek, which is the smartest way to buy and sell tickets. SeatGeek is my go-to for tickets. And whenever I have an extra ticket for a game or concert, I use it. They have the lowest fees in the industry when they're selling. And you're more likely to sell it because people are going to SeatGeek now. SeatGeek aggregates all of the ticket sellers together in one option. You don't have to worry that, oh, I didn't go to this site, I might have missed out on the best deal. They bring it all to you. It's an app, very easy. You don't have to bother with capture, putting in those squiggly lines. Simply go into the app, a couple of swipes, and you've bought your tickets. And now, and hopefully forever, because they will hopefully sponsor the podcast forever, you can get $20 off on your first SeatGeek purchase. If you download the app, go into the settings tab, you can click add a promo code. And that promo code is CAPSPACE, all one word. Do that. Make your first purchase. SeatGeek will send you $20. Support the podcast. Support yourself by saving money by downloading that SeatGeek app today. Move on to the Heat and Bucks.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm trying to figure out why I'm still encouraged by Giannis, even though I'm still concerned about his jumper. And I think part of it is just that he's showing more ways that he can beat defenses, even though he's still not getting all the way there in terms of a shot.
Yeah, he had 10 shot attempts in this game, but 5 turnovers because he does have to drive into traffic a lot. But when he gets out in transition, he's pretty unstoppable. He had a sweet lefty dunk over Hassan Whiteside in this game. And he's been going to the left hand a lot, which is actually like pretty, because a lot of times you'll see guys who are right-handed will kind of take off with their right leg behind them. That's like their bet off of 2 feet. That's your better jumping leg. You want to push off of that leg. But then you have a lot of ground to cover if you're going to dunk with your right hand sort of over your body. So actually with his length, he can kind of quick dunk on people with his left hand before they're expecting it, with his body kind of turned sideways, leading with his left side. And he's getting a lot of people with that. That's a really a move that works really well with what his physical gifts are.
What was your biggest takeaway from this game?
That the Heat were just hopeless offensively with Goran Dragic out, Beno Udrih out. They did not have any pure point guards. Tyler Johnson started. He's a guy who can kind of, you know, make open three-pointers, play off of others, but he was hard-pressed to even bring the ball up. Then they went with Josh Richardson as the backup point guard. Michael Carter-Williams did a great job of pressuring him. And so they had Richardson, Tyler Johnson, Justice Winslow, those three guys on the floor for large stretches together, as Wade only played 20 minutes in this game. He was awful, 1 out of 6. And just no chance of scoring with those three guys on the floor, even when they were going Bosch at center. Luol Deng was totally ineffective in this game, too. He was 1 of 7 at one point, finally finished 4 out of 10. So yeah, I mean, the Heat just were not able to shoot. The Bucks just packed the paint smartly. They did not kind of over pressure the way they do against a lot of other teams. And that was really effective for them. The only Heat players who really had good offensive games were Whiteside and Bosch.
Something I was thinking about is MCW could have a really nice role for himself as a disruptive point guard in second units, just because you think about the guys that are kind of still making it in the league at that spot. He has the physical advantage on a lot of them in a couple different ways. And I mean, I think you kind of want, you're going to have other guys with kind of specific strengths around him, but I think that he could actually thrive in that role, especially because he can back a lot of those guys down. And so you can do that. But the point guards that are starting in this league are so capable that you can't really use those advantages.
Yeah, we saw that, for example, when he would be in against Aaron Brooks in that Bulls playoff series last year. So a lot of these kind of second units have smaller defensive point guards, DJ Augustin, Isaiah Thomas, though he starts now, like those type of guys. So yeah, I think that actually could be a role for him if he can't figure out he has been shooting better lately. Jabari Parker played 35 minutes in this game, actually. As did Chris Middleton. Middleton, as we've talked about, has been on a tear. He had 22 points in this game. Jabari's jumper is starting to come around a little bit the last couple of weeks. We talked about how that didn't look as good. He actually had a couple of nice step backs in this game. Still, not a ton of great signs from him defensively, but at least, you know, they had a good defensive performance overall, only giving up 79 points in this game. And, also, the other problem with him is that he's really just struggles to finish at the rim when there's help. you know, that's another thing that he's going to have to get better at, is once he beats his guy initially, dealing with the big who comes over to help, like Whiteside, who's a great shot blocker, obviously, got him a couple of times. Anything else you had on this game before we move on?
Yeah, just quick, if you were coaching against the Bucks, would you put your best perimeter defender on Middleton right now? It seems like that's the play.
Yeah, that was the play for the Heat. They went with Deng on him. Wade, you know, not a guy who's going to chase shooters around. Wade was actually guarding Jabari, and then they went with Chris Bosh with their starters on Giannis, which I think, you know, that's probably the way to go. That makes sense. And then Wade, you know, against the length of the Bucks, was not able to get anything going in the post at all. His jumper was off. He got a couple of shots blocked when he tried to shoot fadeaways on Giannis, who was guarding him a large part of the time. I thought that those were, it was really a tough matchup for the Heat tonight with the personnel that they had, and Milwaukee did a good job of pressing their advantages. Let's move on to Phoenix and Indiana. Indiana was playing shorthanded without George Hill, which obviously was something that you have talked about. Their point guard depth is not fantastic.
No, it really isn't. And I mean, so you think about Glenn Robinson started, Monte, Paul George, Lavoie Allen, Jan Mahinmi. There isn't really much creation in that. I mean, Monte can create a little bit for himself, but my boy Miles Turner had another good game.
He was fantastic in this game. I mean, his shot blocking, he blocked, I think, four shots in this game, had another two that were taken away by what I thought were bad goaltending calls that were clearly still on the way up. And then there was another one that he blocked that was overturned by replay late in the game and got changed to a jump ball. And he was on fire from mid-range. He hit 4 out of 7 on long twos. He's been hitting long twos really well. Also had maybe the easiest tip dunk in NBA history, as he just waltzed right down the lane and nobody boxed him out. So he's like, his shot blocking really has impressed me a ton, really to the point where I'm thinking about him just as a pure shot blocker right now. The only guy that I would put above him would be Whiteside.
Yeah, and it seems like he's still surprising people with it a little bit, which is such a huge advantage. I mean, every once in a while, Porzingis has that too, where just he's a little bit longer than people think. And one thing that I really like about Turner, and he hasn't gotten all the way there yet, is he's a good shot blocker, and he's not a great defensive rebounder yet, but I think that he'll get better on that end. And those are the guys that I always have an affinity for, is where you can be a good shot blocker, but you can still do that. So then you can become more of a singular defensive center. And I think he has the tools for that. And offensively, I mean, he loves his jumper maybe a little bit more than he should, but if he can fine tune it a little bit and turn these long twos into threes, he becomes something that is exceedingly rare in the NBA.
Yeah, he gets his shot off very quickly. Like, if you pass it to him at chest level, no dip, he just goes right up with it, gets it off very fast. So still not a guy who's going to put it on the floor. I don't see him as being a great pick and roll guy, maybe more of a pick and pop guy. So if he's going to subsist entirely on long twos, he's going to have to find another way to get efficient. I don't see him, you know, he took 11 shot attempts and I think one free throw in this game. So can't only rely on the long twos to be efficient, cause he's going to cool off from there a little bit. Jan Mahinmi did go down in this game with a sprained ankle. They're actually playing Mahinmi and Turner together, of all things. They did not really go small at all in this game, and they started big, just cause they're kind of running out of wings with Hill and, Rodney Suckey injured. But, that Mahinmi ankle didn't look great. He came down on Monte Ellis's foot and sprained it. So that's a little bit of a concern, but we will get to see more Miles Turner.
Yeah, and another one of our rookie crushes, Devin Booker, had one of the best games of his pro career tonight.
Yeah, career high 32 points on 20 shooting possessions, 6 out of 11 from 3, 8 of 8 from the line. Yeah, that's a pretty good way to be efficient. 11 of his 16 shot attempts were threes. He played 40 minutes. Interesting minutes distribution for the Suns. PJ Tucker had played 45 minutes in this game. TJ Warren played 3 minutes. Markieff Morris started the game and then did not play at all in the second half. He played 11 minutes. Warren's 3 minutes, I think he played only a slight bit in the second half and basically kind of sauntered after a loose ball that he should have gotten, and Paul George got it instead, and then he fouled him, and he basically came out of the game immediately after going 0-for-1. Sonny Weems played 10 minutes, really just total chaos for Jeff Hornacek's rotation. I mean, it's hard to really understand exactly what the thinking is from game to game, like what's disciplinary, what's performance, what's trying to motivate guys, like what it is with them. But they have now 13 wins, and they might not even get to 20 by the time the season is over.
But that still might be more than the Wolves. Like, the bottom of this is going to get strangely
Well, the Wolves smacked the Suns, though, over the That's weekend, true. Though. We have to say that they're better than the Suns for the time being. But, I mean, Booker's performance was very encouraging. I mean, that's the one. He's been the one bright spot, really, I would say, for this entire season. The one guy who's played above expectations for this
team. But he's out now.
Well, yeah. I mean, the fact that he got injured, I think, was probably, you know, a blight on that, unfortunately. So Booker, they defended the Pacers okay in this game. Part of the reason that they struggle so much is even with their young guys that they're playing, none of those guys are really like high effort guys at this point, especially with Tyson Chandler kind of looking like he's checked out a little bit, although he did have 14 rebounds in this game. PJ Tucker is the only guy, and I think, you know, that's why he played so much, is just because Hornacek's trying to set the culture of, all right, if you try, you're going to play for the rest of these young guys. But, yeah, it's really ugly in Phoenix. They managed to come back late just with a flurry of three-pointers, but really were not in the game. They were down 20 at one point, kind of let back in. I mean, the Pacers only played Paul George 32 minutes in this game, and they really were didn't have their whole complement either. So not a ton of encouragement that they only lost by three in this game.
Yeah, and the Suns' next two opponents are the Spurs and the Hawks, so good luck.
Oh, man, that Spurs game is going to just be – I mean, what do you think that is, the halftime line, like 20 points in that game? I mean, that's just like,
I think if it was 20, I would bet this. If I bet on basketball, I bet on the Spurs.
Yeah. Yeah. We know nothing about betting, by the way. So it's that's just pure speculation. And someone who knows about it can tell me what an idiotic line that would be.
Sure.
Okay. What else do we have? Denver's and OKC is our last one. And it's cancer was fantastic in this game. I will be completely, unequivocal in saying that.
Yeah, I think both of us, mostly me, because I crack jokes on Enes Kanter a lot on Twitter especially, like, people think that I don't think he's a good basketball player, which is completely not true. It's just that his deficiencies bother me, and I make fun of them because they bother me. But his talent as an offensive rebounder, as an efficient scorer, cannot be denied.
The Thunder had 10 offensive rebounds in the fourth quarter of this game. It was a Darrell Arthur front court, along with at various times either Joffrey Lavernia or Kenneth Faried. Nurkic did not play in this game, and those guys just could not deal with Cantor or Steven Adams on the offensive glass. OKC actually had 16 offensive rebounds overall. They were very cold. They shot 6 out of 28 on threes, but they just kept getting offensive rebound after offensive rebound and getting second chances. And Cantor finally had 25 points on 17 shooting possessions. He even ran the floor hard for a couple of buckets after Denver missed layups in the fourth quarter. It was really an outstanding performance from him. And then, despite that, Billy Donovan went back to Steven Adams and Serge Ibaka to close the game, which I think is actually the right call. Like, you get what you can out of Cantor and don't get seduced into playing him late, because that's when he's really going to get attacked, in the pick and roll with the other team's best players on the floor in crunch time.
You're so rational and cold hearted, Nate, but you're right.
It was, however, part of the reason that the Thunder shot so poorly was campaign. It was at one point, I think he finished 0 for 9, and 0 of 5 on threes, all of which were wide open. Deion Waiters was 2 out of 10. He missed some threes. He was also, getting to the rim, but couldn't finish, you know, which has, been a consistent theme in his career. Kyle Singler actually had some okay minutes. At least was playable in his 10 minutes. You know, they extended the lead when he was out there, but no, 0 minutes for Anthony Morrow. So still, you know, per usual, the Thunder searching for another option, and Denver was doubling off of campaign and Deion Waiters with impunity in the fourth quarter. It just couldn't get a defensive rebound. Otherwise, their defense was actually pretty good.
Yeah, which is, I mean, considering their personnel, is a little bit surprising, but there's a lot to like in Denver. I still, you know, of course, I still am a Moutier guy and will be forever, and I love Gallinari, but I keep on watching them and just thinking, you know, they're still probably a couple years away from their peak, but I could see them being a fringe playoff team next year.
Yeah, Moutier had some moments in this game with 9 assists. He was still 5 out of 14, though, from the field, and 3 of 7 from the line. I think he was 2 of 8 in a recent game as well. He's been awful from the line since he came back from that ankle injury. And I don't really like his free throw routine. He kind of like dribbles a bunch of times, doesn't look at the rim until the very last second, and then he tilts his head sideways as well. It's got to be pretty tough to make a shot when you're tilting your head sideways and you're just kind of losing perspective on what's straight and what isn't. And you'll see him miss left or right a lot, and that could be part of the reason for that in addition to his form. But some encouraging moments. He had some nice finishes in the lane as well in this game. So certainly, you know, some small trouble signs. The free throw thing especially is definitely worrisome for his ceiling. But, you know, he at least has gotten back to playing some decent basketball and, you know, not being just, you know, a complete suck the way he has been at times for Denver this year. And they needed that with Jameer Nelson being out.
Yeah, they did. And I like what I still have always liked about him is that I think he can create for others and he can see passes that most guys can't. And I've seen that in the pros. It's just that everything else is so deficient. And so what the big question with Moutier is can he get those other things to a level that makes him more playable? And the guy who you can probably use to calibrate it is Rubio. And so, like, if he can get above Rubio and everything else, that'd make him a pretty damn good player.
All right, you want to talk a little Team USA here?
Let's do it.
All right, so they put out the 30-man roster. What I would like to do is kind of go through, and I think the easiest way to do this is to just eliminate the guys at first that I feel like have no real chance of being on the team, and also to separate it out by point guard, wing, and big. They usually have taken 3 point guards, one at least one of whom, you know, they've played Curry and Westbrook at the two before in the past. So I think 3 point guards at least is likely. Then a ton of wings, and then they've had between 2 and 3 bigs because they always play basically with a wing at the four, with the exception of the 2014 when they went with Fareed at the four a fair amount of time. So I think you really got 3 spots for traditional bigs, probably 3 for point guards, and then 6 wings. They only get 12 players. So who do you feel like just has no chance of making it at all?
Okay, so I it's funny, like your proposal is very rational. The way I did it was different. I didn't do it by position. I just did it by kind of stratifying them into tiers. And so group that I classified as no, just straight up no, was Barnes, Beal, Connolly, DeRozan, and Rudy Gay. Just like I couldn't figure out a reason why. Like it would be there are just a lot of guys in front of all of them.
Yeah, DeRozan. Now there's a lot of things to remember, right? And we'll have to differentiate between who we think should be on the team and who actually will make it, because there are the issue of the optics. There are, some would say, some wouldn't say, the shadowy Duke, Nike, USA basketball connections. There's the idea of equity. Guys who have been in the program before have kind of earned a spot. There is the idea of just simply just making the team look good and desirable to other players in the future, because that's the most important thing. Like, the most important thing with roster spots, like 9 through 12 on this team, isn't necessarily even fielding the best team. It's just making sure that the best guys will want to play on the team and not that many people get angry. So that's something to consider as well. I agree with you, Barnes, Beal, DeRozan, even though he did play in 2014, but not very much, are probably out. And this is, of course, as everyone's healthy. I'm going to say Gordon Hayward is going to be out. I don't see any way in which he makes it without massive injuries. Andre Iguodala, great equity for USA basketball as well in 2010 and 2012, but really no reason that you would have him on the team when you've got Paul George, Kawhi Leonard types who are as good as he is defensively and also, you know, much more skilled offensively and younger. Kenneth Fareed, I think, is going to be out. You know, granted, he had a really nice 2014 World Cup, but, you know, just not in the class of these other guys. You know, none of these big stars want to put their name into the process and then get beaten out by Kenneth Fareed. And so that would be it for guys I think have, and then Conley as well, guys that I think have no chance of making it.
Or Mike Conley, by the way.
Yeah.
They're probably never going to make an All-Star game. Not even a fringe guy for Team USA. Poor guy.
And then among the bigs as well, the guys that I think should have no chance, Kevin Love and LaMarcus Aldridge, just because those guys are not great rim protectors. They're really more traditional fours. LaMarcus has even has upset Jerry Colangelo before by kind of backing out with not a great reason. Kevin Love does have some equity. He was upset that he, you know, couldn't do it in 2014, supposedly due to his, that the issue with him potentially being traded to Cleveland. But, you know, I don't really see what Love does for this team. If he's playing center, he's just not good enough defensively, and you've got plenty of other shooting on the floor. So I wouldn't include him. All right, so now that we've been through them, let's start with the point guards first. Who do you have as locks, and then who is kind of on the fringe for you among the point guards?
So Curry and Westbrook are the locks. I think that both of them are in. And Chris Paul is a functional one. He has a ton of equity. He's still a very, very good player. So I have him in one of the legacy spots, but he's in the stronger one because he's also a better player than the other guy we'll talk about. And then the players who I think are below them but would be seriously considered for the extra spots would be Kyrie and John Wall. I would have Kyrie over John Wall, mostly because I just think that his off-the-ball ability would be more useful considering how many guys are going to be above him on the totem pole. And yeah, Wall's a better defender, but Kyrie, I think, can be a better standstill guy, and he's somebody who you have to keep a man on at all times.
I agree with you. This point guard list might be the hardest for me. Now, you might say that Curry and Westbrook could play the two as well. Maybe that's a reason to favor Westbrook. I mean, Steph is the best player in the game. If he wants a spot, he's going to get it. Although it will be interesting to see, you know, how, whether, you know, if he's playing on the same team with LeBron and KD, whether, like, they actually treat him like he's the best player in the game. I could still see them sort of, like, everyone's still deferring to LeBron, for which they shouldn't. But in any event, that'll be way down the road. But so Steph is going to be on, especially just because he's such a good shooter as well. He can play off the ball. But really between Westbrook, Paul, and Irving, I think it's actually pretty close among those three guys. I mean, Kyrie, you might want to dismiss. He's not as good of an NBA player as those guys are, obviously. But he also was the most outstanding player in the World Cup. He played in the World Cup. He's got the Nike connection. He's got the Duke connection. So that, I would not be quite so quick to dismiss Irving, and he actually played extremely well in FIBA. Like, that 22-foot three-pointer is like a layup for him.
Can you imagine if he makes this team over Chris Paul? Like,
yeah. And, you know, we could see some guys, you know, this is another sort of little mechanism that they've done in the past where, oh, you know, the guy, they give the guy a chance to kind of declare that he's withdrawing or that he's going to take some time with his family or he's going to rehab some injuries or whatever. But that's more for the Olympics. That's a little bit less likely. I mean, that's going to be really tough,
especially
I think,
for the Rio Olympics. Guys are going to want to play in this.
Yeah, yeah. It is tough for me to say now. Are they going to bring four pointers? I think Wall is pretty clearly going to be on the odd man out again. Even though he was disappointed that he didn't get selected in 2014, he got left off for Derrick Rose, which in retrospect looks pretty ridiculous, but there are some very good reasons for doing that because of the sort of feel-good story of Rose returning, and people didn't realize that he wasn't good anymore quite yet at that point. So yeah, I don't know. I think it's going to be very difficult for them to choose among those. If I had to pick, it would obviously be Westbrook and Paul and Curry. But then again, I mean, the other thing too is, all right, does Chris Paul want to come off the bench? Does he want to not play that many minutes? Like one of those point guards is just going to sit on the bench, you know, and they may not be interested in that either.
Yeah, well, I mean, we'll talk about this a little bit later. I would seriously consider starting two of these guys. But then at the same point, when we start to look at the wings, you go, well, then who's going to sit there? Because the wings
right,
are ridiculous.
Right. I mean, so I think they'll probably go three point guards and then six wings and three bigs. And maybe they'll go only two bigs and go with seven wings. So here are my locks for the wings. LeBron, Kevin Durant, Paul George. I think Paul George, after what, you know, getting injured, he's got a spot on this team for sure. Like the optics, he just has to. Even though I actually wouldn't, you know, I'd rather go Kawhi over him. Kawhi, I think, I don't remember why he didn't play in 2014. I think he just sort of like,
I think he gave kind of a specious reason from what I remember.
Yeah, so that could be a reason why we don't necessarily see him. He's also not exactly.
Team.
He's not exactly like Mr. Marketing. I would consider Carmelo a bigger favorite to make it than Kawhi.
I agree with you because the system is unfair. I mean, Kawhi should be starting for Team USA.
I mean, Carmelo, this will be a chance for him to get a third gold medal. Yeah,
Carmelo.
Well,
so I want to make a small point with him.
Yeah.
I would got really frustrated with the whole Kobe Bryant equity with Team USA thing, because I think that Kobe Bryant has a ton of NBA equity. I think Carmelo has meaningfully more Team USA equity than Kobe does, because I think he played a bigger active role in the positives and not in the negatives. And for whatever reason, that's being discounted because, oh, Kobe Bryant's super famous. But I think Melo's case to be on this team is stronger beyond the playing quality than Kobe's.
Yeah, I mean, Melo is really, along with LeBron in some ways, is the kind of symbol of their redemption. He's always been awesome in FIBA too. I mean, he's nowhere near the player that a lot of these guys are, frankly. But, you know, he's also, as he's kind of a vet, you have an excuse to not really play him all that much either. You know, you can maybe have him come in and just kind of light it up in some games, and, you know, 10 minutes a game, just bomb away or whatever. You know, and it's not the end of the world. He's coming off an injury. It can make a little more sense to just not play him as much. But I mean, all right, so LeBron, Durant, Kawhi Leonard, Paul George, Anthony, we haven't even gotten to James Harden, Jimmy Butler, or Klay Thompson yet. So that is 8 guys. So 2 of those guys at least are going to not make this team, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I love Jimmy Butler. He's just a little bit superfluous, you think about, especially Paul George kind of being above him, and for a couple reasons that are fair and you could say unfair to Jimmy Butler alike. Just it's overly.
I'd rather have Paul George.
So would I. But I think that that's a clear cut thing. You know, like if we're being realistic about this, and so the really kind of interesting question to me is with Harden, because I think that while Harden is a better player right now than Klay Thompson is, Klay Thompson fits what you want in kind of like a 11th to 12th guy on this team so much better than James Harden does.
Yeah, he can defend some point guards who are hot. I mean, he's not the lockdown down guy that you might hope, but there also are not any wings that are of the type that are going to give him trouble either. You know, the sort of more physical guys who are going to knock him backward and get space for their shot. You know, those guys generally don't really exist on these other teams unless it's Giannis, and there's plenty of other guys who can guard him.
And his shot in FIBA is just filth.
Yeah, that's true too. You know, he's even, you know, 2 years better now than he was in 2014. He's got some equity there as well. I would say Jimmy Butler has very little chance of actually making it, because I don't think that he is a great guy as far as, you know, when he doesn't have the ball in his hands, not an amazing standstill 3-point shooter. So I would kind of put him off that list. And now it's just kind of a question of, all right, you know, who should make it? I have an easy answer for you. It should be LeBron, KD, Kawhi Leonard, Paul George. Klay Thompson and James Harden are like the 6 best wings easily to me. But, you know, Carmelo still has the equity, Kawhi maybe doesn't. So I don't know. It's going to be real interesting to see. And then we get to the bigs, and that's another question. Do you want to keep 2 bigs or 3? I mean, I would probably rather get more bigs just because there are always going to be enough wings, and you may just run out of bigs due to foul trouble or injury or whatever, and you can't replace guys once somebody gets hurt. So I probably would go with 3 bigs just because it's a potential emergency, even if, you know, those guys just aren't as good of players as some of these wing guys. But they're also not as famous as some of the wing guys.
Yeah, I agree with you on all those. The thing that I think is really intriguing is, I think Melo's going to make this team if he wants it, is I think that I would have Klay over Harden, and I think Team USA, if that were the choice, would do the same thing.
Well, yeah, I guess. Neither of their shoe contracts matters. Klay is with Anta.
No, isn't Harden with Nike now?
No, Adidas.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, no, he's like the big Adidas guy.
Okay.
Now.
Yeah. I am admittedly super not knowledgeable about who's with who.
Yeah. So here are our bigs: Anthony Davis, Locke, right? I mean, he's played 2 in a row. He was the center on the World Cup team. He'll probably be the starting center on this team, I think, very easily with his ability to switch. I mean, he can even shoot threes now from the FIBA line, no problem. Block a lot of shots, his mobility, like he'll definitely be, I think, the starting center on this team. But then it gets really interesting.
Yeah, so I think you have to have at least one quote-unquote traditional center on this team. And to me,
so can we run? Let's run through the options.
First. Okay, so of the traditional centers, or do you want to do all the bigs?
Well, no, just all the bigs. So we've got Draymond Green, Andre Drummond, DeMarcus Cousins, Dwight Howard, Blake Griffin, and DeAndre Jordan. And so we basically, I think, we have to pick 3 of those.
Yeah, And so I think to me, the way where you start is you want at least one of those to be a traditional center. So for me, that's Drummond, Cousins, Dwight, and DeAndre. I think that there's an interesting argument for Dwight just because the idea of, you know, equity and all that. But for me, it goes down to Drummond and Cousins. And the reason I would go Drummond is I think he's a better defender. And we've talked about it with Clay versus Harden, is that the lower usage guy is probably better just because you're not going to need them to do more. I also will be convinced for the rest of my life that if he ever wanted to do it, Drummond would just be a demon with the FIBA goaltending rule.
Yeah, I mean, the offensive rebounding of Drummond could provide something. I mean, remember that both Drummond and Cousins were on this team in 2014, although Drummond actually was the fourth string center behind Mason Plumlee, hilariously enough. I don't know. It's going to be a tough call to me. I actually think that for what this team needs, as long as he were healthy, Dwight Howard would actually be a better choice. I still think he is a better defensive player than either of those two guys, and that's what they really need, is just someone who's going to play great pick-and-roll defense and protect the rim. I think he's better at that than either of those two guys are.
That's certainly a fair opinion to have.
Now, Dwight also, I mean, things are going to be getting started pretty early, I think, for this in this cycle, and Dwight is going to be a free agent. That could enter into things, just his overall health status. But this will really probably be his last chance to play in an Olympics as well. And in fact, he played in 08.
He played in 08.
Yeah, he played in 08. He couldn't play in 2012 because of the back surgery. Yeah. But
so would you take one or two traditional fives?
I don't think it really matters. I think all these guys can play the five in their system. You know, I mean, maybe you're thinking just because, like, Spain is going to post up with, like, Gasol or Gasol.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. I think maybe that's another reason to go to Howard as well. He's probably the best post defender of those three. But if he's not available, I mean, I think it makes more sense. I think Draymond should be on this team.
So do I.
Absolutely, just because of his ability to switch. He still is a pretty stout post defender. He can shoot threes, grab and go in transition, just the versatility that he would provide. I think he is, you know, probably at this point, maybe other than Blake Griffin, the second best just overall player in the NBA of these guys right now. I mean, maybe you could say DeMarcus when he's locked in, but Draymond has a good attitude, but he doesn't have quite the equity. He's just sort of been around in some of the training camps. And also worth noting, by the way, they're just going to select the 12 guys. There's not going to be a training camp where the guys actually try out like there has been in past years, because I think they felt like that kind of led to some hurt feelings in the past. And also the Olympics is kind of a bigger deal. You know, they don't have some of these lesser lights where they know what these guys are. Whereas with the World Cup, you had some guys who were trying to come in and play a role that they weren't as familiar with.
Yeah. I mean, and especially because Draymond opens up just some of the truly mind-bending lineups that Team USA could trot out there. I mean, you think about all the defensive talent that you have on the wing, and you could just throw kind of like even more evil versions of the death lineup out there.
Yeah, I mean, that could be one theoretical reason that you might want to go with Thompson, Green, and Curry, is all just because of their familiarity with one another. And then you put in, like, you know, Kevin Durant.
Put in future teammate Kevin Durant.
With those guys. All right, so, I mean, DeAndre Jordan, you wouldn't consider him over Drummond or Cousins? I actually might kind of like him a little bit better than those guys just because of his ability to finish alley-oops. He's the best of those guys and, you know, probably is actually the best pick-and-roll player of any of those guys.
I think he chases blocks a little bit too much, and you just don't really need that from this group. And also, he and Drummond are both terrible free throw shooters, but
yeah, that's something to consider too. That could be a reason to go.
Well, idea, if you're going, if it's that marginal a choice, I would lean towards the guy who has a meaningful chance of being a part of the next Team USA, you know, the next Olympic team, let's say, not as much the next. And I think that Drummond is the guy on the ascendance. And I think that would be a good thing to do, you know, if you're giving that.
And also a guy who's not going to bitch about it if he's not playing that much either, because he already made it through a year when he played a lot and didn't complain.
Yeah. How did they not put all three Pumley brothers on this 30?
Blake Griffin, though, I would not have him on the team for similar reasons as Love. I mean, he's going to be a center as a guy who doesn't really shoot threes. on this team, doesn't really protect the rim. You got plenty of other guys who can create. The skills that he provides in the NBA, to me, don't have a lot of value added when you're on this star-studded of a roster. Also a guy who's had some health issues, and so I think, and maybe a guy who's considers himself too big of a star to sit on the bench. On the other hand, he's like considered pretty marketable. Maybe that's a reason that he could be in there. Another guy with Nike connections as well. So it's a lot of intrigue here, but I definitely think if you're trying to pick the best team, Blake Griffin is not on it as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, which is pretty remarkable considering we both had him in the MVP, like the top five MVP conversation early in this year. It's just that with the way that this works out, and also Griffin is a guy who is less good in international play. Like there are certain guys whose abilities are augmented by it, and there are certain guys who are detracted, and I think he's clearly in the second group.
Well, offensively, he'd be unbelievable. He probably would be, you know, maybe even the better pick and roll player than any of these guys, as sort of like a combination of what Draymond Green can do with his playmaking on short rolls and the dunking ability of some of the other guys. So I think he'd be great offensively, but this team is really gonna, you know, defense is really the most important thing for this team. They're not gonna have any trouble scoring, and I think that's why you need guys who are gonna be better defensively. So who's your final three? AD, Draymond, and who's your last guy? All right, I would go with Dwight Howard. If he's not available, I think I would do DeAndre Jordan, actually.
Okay.
But I don't think that will happen. This is what we think should happen.
Right.
What will happen is almost more difficult to predict.
My guess on that is Blake makes it over Draymond, and various people go insane.
Yeah, that will be real interesting. I mean, Draymond just, you know, does not have, I mean, if they win another championship and they, set the wins record or come close or, you know, are an all-time great team, maybe he will be at that point. If he starts the All-Star game, we'll see what the final tally is there as well. Maybe that gives him a little more street cred. And if he doesn't make the team, then that's, and Klay Thompson too, another guy who might not make the team. That's more, there's your motivation for the Warriors 2016-2017 season.
Yeah, if more Clippers make the team than Warriors, I think they'll have something to say about that.
All right, anything to plug before we go?
Nope.
This is like the first time that's ever been the case.
Yeah, I'm working on...
You get lazy?
No, I'm working on some stuff that's not finished yet. And I'm recording on Thursday, and I'm doing my podcast on Thursday, so...
All right, I wrote a piece for The Cauldron expanding on our episode where we talked about some of the free agency winners and losers for the upcoming free agency period in 2016 at The Cauldron. Check that out. Follow me on Facebook at Nate Duncan NBA. We're probably due for a Facebook mailbag again soon. And also we're going to get those sort of like deep dive little team episodes going. So hit me up on Facebook. That's probably a little more permanent than Twitter. I'm more likely to see it there, you know, with some of your ideas for which teams we should focus on first, which are the most intriguing. And also use that CastSpace code on SeatGeek to support the program as well. So thanks again, Danny, for coming on. We will talk to you all next time.